David Sterling, the phony major, aristocrat, gambler, innovator, and special forces legend. The life of David Sterling should need no retelling. His formation of the Special Air Service in the summer of 1941 led to a new form of warfare, and he's remembered as the father of special forces soldiering. But was he really a military genius, or was he in fact a shameless self-publicist who manipulated people and the truth for his own ends? That's the subject of a new book by Gavin Mortimer called David Sterling, the Phony Major. Delighted to be joining me live on the line. Gavin himself. Good morning to you, Gavin.
Good morning, Giles.
If you mention the name David Sterling, a lot of people will say, you know, what a hero, formed the SAS from the long-range patrol group, of course, fighting in the deserts of Africa, and basically led to the SAS as we know them today. You've looked behind that and take issue with him being this heroic figure.
Yes, I do. I've been studying the wartime SAS and special forces in general for about a quarter of a century now. 1998 was the year that I interviewed my first SAS veteran. And at the time, I was a young man. I was in my 20s, and I very much bought into the Sterling myth. And it was really as I spoke to more veterans. I've spoken to scores of SAS and Long Range Desert Group veterans over the years, and as I matured as a writer and I really delved deeper into the subject rather than relying on the books that were published in the 50s and 60s, particularly The Phantom Major, which was really Sterling's autobiography. I just began to ask myself more and more questions, and I thought something's not right here. And then I began to compare, and I went into other records from GHQ in Cairo, and really found some pretty damning comments written about Sterling. And so the fruit of this is the book The Phony Major, where I say that he was, you mentioned in your introduction, a shameless self-publicist. I think that's a good description of him. And really, he was a physically brave man, don't get me wrong. And he was very much an ideas man. But as an act, he didn't have a temperament for guerrilla warfare. And mainly his greatest fault is that after the war, particularly with the death of Paddy Mayne, who some of your listeners will be familiar with. He was this great Irishman, a rugby international before the war, and the second in command of the SAS. He really was the physical force of the SAS. But he died in a car crash in 1955. Sterling had always been very envious of Mayne. He'd even been intimidated by him. And so with the death of Mayne, there was really no one else left to challenge the rewriting of the SAS history. And the book The Phantom Major was published in 1958, not long after Mayne's death. And this really began the complete mythology surrounding David Sterling.
So take it back a bit then. So it's 1941. The genesis, if you like, the origins of the SAS are the Long Range Desert Patrol Group. So what was Sterling's involvement and Mayne's involvement? And because Sterling needed to sell the idea, didn't he? He needed to get Churchill to buy into the idea of this highly trained, sort of band of not brigands, but you know, highly trained, secretive, highly mobile group of soldiers wreaking havoc.
That's right, as a new type of warfare, as you said earlier. Now, the other person that features very heavily in the book, Giles, is Bill Sterling. That was David's elder brother. Now, what I say is that actually it's Bill Sterling who is the really the founder of the SAS. I said that Paddy Mayne was the physical force of the SAS. The intellectual force was Bill Sterling. Now, Bill was 4 years older than David, and their father died in 1932, and they came from an aristocratic Scottish family, and so Bill inherited a lot of land, a lot of money, a lot of status, and he was a very confident young man, and he was involved from beginning of 1940 with SOE, Special Operations Executive, which was sort of secret agent type stuff, without going into too much detail. And he went on his first guerrilla mission in April 1940. He saw how ill-prepared Britain was for this type of warfare, which was... it was very new. It was still in its infancy. It was... taking advantage of the technological advances in the interwar years of communications, weapons, transport, particularly aircraft, and he saw the potential. So in June 1940, he'd taken to the War Office the idea of a guerrilla training centre. He got permission, so he opened it in the northwest of Scotland. He was a chief instructor. One of his first pupils was his brother, David. So it's from the outset, it's Bill who really understands special forces warfare. In the summer of 1941, Bill is working for GHQ. He's the assistant for the chief of the general staff, another indication of how highly he's valued, his intelligence, his expertise. David, who was always a bit of a, well, to use the jargon of the time, Giles, a lounge lizard. Before the war, he'd really drifted and he'd shown an inability to settle down. Bill, being a good big brother, had always looked out for him. And David did have the idea, I said he was an ideas man, of a parachute force. Bill, with David, the two of them fleshed this out. And Bill, who obviously being at the very heart of Middle East headquarters, knew intimately how best to utilize his force and to really he evolved David's initial idea. And then having access to the chief of the general staff, it was Bill who took the idea, and it was they thought it was a good idea, and they worked in conjunction with, you mentioned earlier, the Long Range Desert Group. But it was very much so Bill was very much the brains behind it, and David was the salesman. David had a lot of charisma, physically brave. Bill, being older, was very much more sort of the office type, the administrator, the chief executive. And it was David who was to lead this combat unit. But then again, that brings in Paddy Maine, who was a force of nature, and psychologically he soon became the leader. And that's why David was envious of Paddy, because Paddy Maine was blowing up aircraft left, right and centre. In two raids in December 1941, he and five men blew up 51 enemy aircraft. David Stirling, the same month, two raids, no success.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because it took a particular, shall we say, mindset to be successful at this sort of a warfare. And if you go through the history of the SAS and what they were up to after the, you know, the desert campaigns, they go into Italy and they, you know, I mean, a lot of them don't survive. So actually, if you wanted to falsify or perhaps embellish your role, then this was the perfect group in which to do it.
Absolutely. I mean, this is, psychologically, this was a new form of warfare, as you've mentioned. And so we still didn't really know the SAS selection today was all these TV programs that we know it's very rigorous. And it's a real test of one physically and psychologically. Back in 1941, we didn't really know this. You just sort of asked for volunteers. But Paddy Maine was just, it was a stroke of good fortune, I suppose, that he here was a man in the right time at the right place. And David Stirling, I say in the book, Giles, that I admire him for his physical courage and giving it a go. But he didn't have much moral or intellectual courage, and he should have recognized that, like his brother Bill, his best place was in HQ directing it, and that it, he he actually became a liability in the field. I say in the book that he actually endangered the lives of his men because he was so desperate to prove himself, he became reckless. Now, Paddy Mayne has a reputation for completely wrong for being reckless, not at all, and he always planned meticulously. He would never commit his men to an operation if he didn't think it had more than a 50% chance of success, which was normal for this type of guerrilla warfare. But David Stirling wasn't like that, and he really and that's how he got captured in January 1943 on a completely unnecessary and poorly organized and poorly thought out mission, driving into Tunisia. And so he spent the rest of the war in a prisoner of war camp. In the meantime, Paddy Mayne really took the SAS to a next level, as you just mentioned about Italy and France. And it became a brigade by the end of the war, 2,500 men. And really, I suppose that was the start of its legendary reputation, obviously, that we know today.
Because it would have been very easy to wind it down had it just remained a sort of desert force. I mean, after the war, you could have said, okay, well, that's job done, chaps. Off you go back to your other regiments. What information then did you unearth to find out Stirling's background and his actual, if you like, this as you describe it, sort of recklessness?
A lot of the contemporary newspapers of the time. I mean, interestingly, I also pick away or really reveal, I suppose, that a lot of his backstory was made up. So, for example, if you look on Wikipedia and David Stirling, it says that he was preparing to climb Everest when war broke out, and he went to America to climb Everest. In fact, he didn't. He went there. He was sent there by his mother, and who was at a wit's end what to do with him, and Bill Stirling, to ranch. They had a family friend in El Paso who owned a ranch. And this is all in the contemporary. There's a tatler I discovered in 1938 when David was sent to ranch, and it sort of rather sniggeringly says, "Oh, the Honourable Mrs. Stirling has dispatched David to Texas to ranch, and in the hope that it will do him some good." And when the initial the Phantom Major, by the way, Giles, this is Stirling would have you believe again that the common misconception is that this was a name given to him by Rommel. Because of Stirling's ability to slip unseen onto German airfields and blow up aircraft, which nothing of the sort. On one raid, for example, he stumbled into a trench containing two snoring Italian sentries and woke them up. He was anything but elusive. But it was actually Randolph Churchill who came up with the name in August 1942 of the Phantom Major. The Phantom Major was actually a notorious murder case in Britain in the 1920s of a First World War major who murdered his wife. And it was for propaganda purposes. And this I unearthed in the newspapers of the time. In these newspaper articles of the time, it says that he went to America to ranch and et cetera. He also would have us believe that he spent a year or so in Paris in the 1930s under a great French cubist painter, André Haute. Again, that's untrue. This only appeared later in life, and I checked with their archives, and there's no trace of Stirling. But also just going into the National Archives and looking at the files connected with the SAS, not necessarily the SAS files themselves, but more with the GHQ files, with the Long Range Desert Group, who became increasingly exasperated by Stirling's rather slapstick approach to logistics, to administration, to organization. And time and again, you see the Long Range Desert Group complaining, sending these in one instance, they complain of having to play universal aunt to Sterling and his SAS men. In other words, having to go and collect them, because Sterling didn't. He relied on the long-range desert group. He didn't teach his men. He didn't think to himself, "Hey, it would be a good idea if we learned how to navigate." Or if we got a signals unit. No, they just relied on the long-range desert group. He was fundamentally lazy. So it was just picking all these threads together, really. And as I said, with the interviews of the men, I mean, one thing that always struck me was that the men talked in reverence of Paddy Mayne, and even Bill Sterling to an extent. But when they talked of David Sterling, it was much more dispassionately, and that had always rather puzzled me. And again, it was a case of bringing all these different strands together.
So is it a case then, do you think, I mean, after Mayne's death in 55, of Sterling basically thinking, I've got an opportunity, because he didn't have much to do with the regiment, did he, after, between that period of his capture until Mayne's death? He saw it as an opportunity, and as I mentioned before, a lot of the people who'd served during the war weren't around, to put it mildly, and so he could go in and say, well, actually, you know, I was doing this, that, and the other. And, you know, basic question, because Sterling, you know, a lot of people say he's my hero. I've had a WhatsApp in saying, David Sterling's a British hero. So, therefore, why did nobody in the SAS who aren't backwards in coming forward saying, hang on a second, you know, this isn't how it was?
Yeah, well, the SAS of the time, one has to remember, of course, firstly, your first point, and that's right, he saw his opportunity, because twice before, he took himself off to Southern Africa immediately after the war for 10 years, had nothing to do with the SAS, and then, as I said, when Mayne died, back he came, and soon this book was in print. He had actually tried twice before to get a book into print. Once a collaboration with other officers, one of whom was Paddy Mayne. Nothing came of that, I suspect, because Mayne refused to have anything to do with it. A second time, it was only his own individual memoir, and it was rejected by quite a well-known publisher. This is in 1951, who said it was they found it rather disappointing, and it was just really not rather dull. In other words, it was a true story. It was his own true accounts. When Sterling died, when Mayne died, he was able to embellish it. Now, most of the other original officers from the SAS, such as Jock Lewis, had been killed early in the war, so they weren't around to question it. And one has to remember, Giles, 1950s, totally different Britain, very differential. Sterling was an aristocrat, upper class, working class lads were certainly not going to question the word of someone like Sterling. He was an establishment man. He took tea with the Queen. He knew prime ministers. He was a very powerful figure. And his brother, now, of course, why didn't Bill Sterling say anything? Well, Bill Sterling knew his brother's flaws. And he was a successful businessman after the war. He had quite a large expanding family, and he signed the Official Secrets Act. And he was happy to take to remain in the shadows. I mean, it's interesting that even the SAS War Diary, which was published in 1946 and is like a compendium of SAS operations, describes Bill Sterling as the man from the shadows. He was the opposite of David, always very discreet. And he knew from the 1930s onwards that David really was a man without purpose, an insecure man, an immature man. And so he was happy to let David have his time in the limelight. And of course, it's just his when the book came out, I mean, one or two reviews were questioned it, said he'd something here is he it's rather the prose is rather purple. But at the time, one mustn't forget, this was 1958, just not long after the Suez Crisis. Britain was in the empire was breaking up, more and more former countries demanding independence. So Britain's confidence as a country was at a low ebb, and it needed a hero. And along came the Phantom Major, and he fulfilled that role. And of course, what I say, I mean, if I can just say, Giles, sure, that, you know, you've got that email about David Sterling's my hero. What I'm not doing, I'm not jumping on this pull down statues bandwagon. I'm a fan of Winston Churchill. I think that he's been very unfairly criticized in the last few years by people with a political agenda, taking his words out of context. I'm not doing that with Sterling. I'm actually revealing that he has misinterpreted history to his own ends. And most, his greatest fault in my eyes is not only did he embellish his own exploits, but he actually diminished others. Paddy Mayne, he portrayed as this undisciplined, intemperate, sullen, and callous Irishman, and that isn't Paddy Mayne. And he also wrote Bill Sterling out of the story. In The Phantom Major, Bill Sterling is mentioned four times in the index, which is nothing short of scandalous, seeing as he was really that. I mean, I describe Bill Sterling as the father of British Special Forces. So I'm not at all into, there's a statue of Sterling unveiled in 20 years ago. Good. He was a remarkable man in many ways. What I'm actually saying is there should be another statue erected of his brother.
Yeah, again, it'd be very easy to, because I was about to say, you know, when you're dealing, because you've written, but this isn't your first book about, you know, special operations, so you know what you're talking about. You're not just having a pop at somebody.
No, exactly.
And so you must, obviously, you have to be very, well, you have to treat it like a historian. You have to go and get the facts and get the archives and say, well, no, this it doesn't add up, if you like. It's a detective book almost, isn't it? Because you're revealing.
I mean, absolutely, Joe. That's a really good way of describing it. It's a detective trail. The other thing I should point out, too, by the way, I mean, it's a big book. I've got a copy here in front of me. What is it? It's about 430 pages. And about a third of it covers post-war.
Yeah.
And, I quote, Sterling dabbled in Southern Africa, in the Middle East, in Saudi Arabia, a region in the 1960s, which was a sort of a proxy Cold War. And I quote, the Colonial Office, the sort of like the Foreign Office, really, describing him as unreliable, wildly indiscreet, somewhat excitable, that wild man. I mean, you know, this is a man with a reputation for volatility. And another thing, by the way, which I mentioned in the book, three times in the war, he was tricked by imposters, German informants, into giving away intelligence. He was really everything that a special forces commander shouldn't be. As the Colonial Office said, he was wildly indiscreet. He just couldn't help shooting his mouth off because, like all insecure men, he had a tendency to brag.
And he's done that, obviously, in the book The Phantom Major. Hopefully people will read the book and you know, discover more about the real heroes behind the SAS, like you said, Paddy Mayne, for example, like Bill Sterling as well. Is that what you hope that people will come to see? So that, you know, the fact that because Sterling wrote The Phantom Major, he obscured the history of men like Jock as well, who, you know, the Pirate of the Great Sand Sea, I think it was nicknamed.
That's right. The long range desert, exactly, Giles. Yeah, the long range desert group, and who have really again been robbed. They were sort of diminished by Sterling, and without the long range desert group, the SAS would not have survived 1941. They really lent them their expertise in navigating across the vast expanse of the Libyan desert. And that's right. And Paddy Mayne, who's been very unfairly, I mean, his reputation in the last 30 or 40 years has really taken a battering. And, you know, you hear now, you Google him and you'll find words of, you know, misfit, psychopath. And he was nothing of the sort. You know, for goodness sake, he studied law at Queen's University. He just qualified as a solicitor in 1939. This is not, a knuckle-dragging meathead. He was a very intelligent man, and he was, as several veterans told me, he was a tactical genius. And then you've got Bill Sterling, who was a strategic mastermind. And really, the two of them were, I said before, you got one who was the intellectual genius and the other one who was the physical genius. And that's, you know, that Paddy Mayne was that. He was just a a supreme guerrilla fighter, a DSO and three bars. He was awarded the DSO four times. He was actually recommended for a Victoria Cross later on in the war, and I believe he should have got one. So it's bringing, it's, I suppose, in a way, it's to summarise, Giles, it's rehabilitating Paddy Mayne, this book, but also revealing the extent of Bill Stirling's contribution to not just the SAS, but British Special Forces. And I said earlier, I believe that he should be known as the father of British Special Forces.
The book is called David Stirling, The Phony Major, The Lifetimes and Truth About the Founder of the SAS. It's by Gavin Mortimer, who we've been speaking to today. Gavin, if people want to find out more information about you or about the book or any of the books you've written, where can they find you?
I am on Twitter at the Phony Major, and I tweet really anything connected with wartime special forces. Today I've been talking about the Long Range Desert Group, I'm always happy to discuss this in a civilized, courteous way, and people to put their point of view across, and I'll put my point of view across, what I just ask is read the book first, and I think 24 years I've been researching this subject, and I think I've done a pretty balanced job in it's not, someone accused me recently of on Twitter of a character assassination. I would argue that there's a difference between a character assassination and legitimate criticism of someone who has manipulated the truth for their own ends, and that's what David Stirling has done.
You'll be able to download the book as well from our own virtual bookstore. I urge you to do it. The book is called David Stirling, The Phony Major. It's by Gavin Mortimer. Gavin, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for the invitation. It's been good to talk.